we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to the How Did It Make Sense podcast. This is episode, not quite sure actually, we'll see where things go. Because there we go, life is a bit variable like that, and I'm not quite sure when this one's going out. On today's episode, I've got a guy called Ken Wiley, who I met about 18 months ago out on Vancouver Island. And we've got a lot in common and exchanged a whole bunch of stuff on LinkedIn and had a great discussion while I was out there on a diving piece, and he comes from that area. So, Ken, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got to be where you are. And then we'll come into the stories that need to be told.
Thanks, Gareth. It's really an honor to join you on your podcast. I learn a ton from having conversations with people like yourself, and it's always this expansive experience. So thank you so much. How did I get to be where I am? I run an organization called Archetypal, and we focus primarily on human hazard management. And I'm using a little bit different language, but we'll probably explain that a little bit more later. But I started as a young man super interested in doing cool stuff in the mountains. And that eventually led to working in the adventure education space. And I actually think that that decision really impacted how I see not only safety, but also kind of the reason we adventure. And adventure education, of course, is using adventure activities as a means of, you know, human development, personal growth, that kind of thing. And many people kind of link it to, okay, this is, you know, hoods in the woods or troubled youth. And I did a lot of work with Outward Bound, which kind of had that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. kind of had that, you know, kind of reputation. But adventure education is really a powerful tool for even corporate groups and so that being in that mindset of using, you know, what we experience in the outdoors as a means for reflecting on our own personal journeys, that has been fundamental in terms of how my worldview kind of within the risk management adventure space. And I would actually say, I don't think it's too much of a stretch that it really kind of helped me save my own life, mm-hmm. because I was in a real terrible accident in 2003. Well, a euphemism for tragedy, and actually coming back from that, the key element was, okay, I've got to learn from this. If I didn't have that mindset, oh, this is just another thing to learn from, I think that it would have been almost impossible to come back from that tragedy. And it's a, you know, kind of a process of, okay, I've got to learn from this. And what that means is it's about my stuff. It's about how I was showing up to the situation. Mm. And what's really interesting, Gareth, is that it's a gift that keeps on giving, right? Like, as I develop, then I actually change my perspective. And so I learn more, and then I learn more, and I change my perspective, and I learn more. And so, you know, this idea that, oh, well, you know, this is a really old accident, we've learned the lessons from it. Well, actually, if you learn the lessons, then you have a different perspective. And, you know, and it kind of just carries on, and it just keeps giving gifts, so to speak.
No, it's a great insight. And I think it's that piece of having this sort of frame of, or this mindset of continually learning and looking at things differently. And it's one of the things that I love doing. And one of the reasons that sort of put this podcast together is to work across multiple different domains, get people to tell stories. And they're very unlikely to encounter the same situation again. But the way that those who we're talking with explain it, they're able to abstract out into different spaces. And I think that's a critical piece, is the ability to view an event through one lens and then the ability to abstract it into something else. As an example, this week playing the Jenga game, who was last to touch it? And it's the first time I've played it in a corporate environment, and there was a lady wearing a tight dress. And she had problems reaching across the table to get to the tower to pull the pieces out. And we were in a ground handling aviation safety meeting. And it's like, PPE, do women have the right fit for their clothing to be able to do their job? And I've never come across that in a training environment before. And it's like, there we go. And so we brought it out and said, right, how well is this PPE? So it's that ability to look at something and go, yeah, okay, fine, I can see that, but how do I use it? And that's really what I want to do with these podcasts. So the sort of standard format is to tell a first story. And for those who've, you know, may not have listened to this, first stories are those which are simple, linear, often judgmental, full of counterfactuals. And they're the ones that normally get told. So are you able to share your first story, which we'll then dig into with the second story?
Yeah, my first story is in 2003, I was working as an apprentice / assistant ski guide. And what that means is that we were flown in by helicopter to a backcountry lodge, and the aim was to ski up the mountains. I know that sounds really kind of bizarre, but...
Stick skins but, on, yeah. Stick wax on, off you go.
Yes, and the aim was to, you know, ski as much vertical in a week as possible, and that season started early, and there was a problem in the snowpack. There was an early rain event in November, and you know, put down an ice crust in the snowpack, and then. All of December and January's snow was on top of that. And so we had this real deep instability, we call it, in the snowpack, and that was a known. And what was interesting is that the way we were, the operation was kind of conducting itself was, and we see this a lot in different case studies, is that it was business as usual. Even though there was something that was fundamentally problematic with the medium that we were working with, snow, and so, you know, just, you know, if you want to use Diane Vaughan's term, you know, kind of normalization of deviance, we were kind of fully engaged in that behavior of not really paying attention to the current reality as well as we could have. Mm-hmm. And also not managing the risks by, you know, splitting our groups up more effectively and communicating really well. You know, I think that when we have different adversities, like if we have a technical adversity and maybe even a financial adversity, if we pile onto that a social adversity where we're not getting along, then we end up with the kind of this
real tension.
Terrible triangle that becomes the recipe. It completes the recipe. Like we can navigate a lot of fiscal or financial challenges, and we can navigate a lot of technical challenges, but if we're not getting along, that means we're not listening, we're not sharing information. It means a whole host of things. And if I were to say what the cause of the accident was, I would never say it was a, you know, a rain crust in the snowpack. I would say, well, we weren't managing that risk properly.
Yeah, and often that's the first story is that there was an accident happened, they weren't paying attention, they were taking too many risks. It was obvious that the failure was going to happen. But actually, and you've already started to dig into that second story piece. So extending that first story, what was the outcome then of that first story?
There were 13, the avalanche was triggered from near ridgetop by the few people at the front where the snowpack was shallower. And it broke in the middle of the upper group and buried 13 of us. And there were 8 people left on the surface. We were fortunate in that it didn't release when everyone was on the slope.
Okay.
If it had released when everyone was on the slope, then there's a potential that 21 people would have been buried, and there's no recovery from that. Mm-hmm. And so one of the only kind of safety mechanism backcountry skiers really have is each other. You know, even helicopter skiing, to rely on the machine is, you know, to bring in resources is already too late.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, you've got a limited timeline.
Yeah, you understand.
Yeah, so from a diving point of view, for finite resources, absolutely.
Yeah, you might be lucky to have an air pocket, and that's a limited resource for breathing. And so 13 of us were buried. They recovered 6. Six of us, and 7 people were killed, unfortunately.
So it's an interesting use of a word there. You said unfortunately, and I often sort of bring into these environments where we're dealing with uncertainties, you know, asking people, were you good or were you lucky? And conversely, were you unlucky or unfortunately? And I think it's something that people don't really consider is what role luck plays in the outcomes, be that a positive outcome or a negative outcome, that the order of those skiers could have been a different way around. So actually some people been in a different environment. And so we're in the survival side rather than the loss side.
Yeah, and that brings up an interesting point, because that's a double-sided coin. Mm. You know, were we good or are we lucky? And it's probably both. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you know, Gareth, before I kind of latched onto the idea that I had to learn from this, I didn't feel lucky to have survived.
Interesting.
Because it was really big, mm-hmm. right? And I'm only saying that from the perspective of one of the things I have is a window to the worst case scenario and what it's like living with the worst case scenario. Because it's one of the things that we do when we look at case studies is we can, you know, there's a little narrative. Yeah, this is really interesting, but that would never happen to me.
Yeah.
And I don't think that
to you.
It has happened to me, and I don't perceive myself as being especially bad, right? Like, I actually think that we made a whole series of compromises that most people would make.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then those compromises, they add up.
Yeah, and there's this sort of perception that bad things happen to bad people. And it's their choices. And this is one of my sort of big frustrations. They chose to be unsafe, you know, in whatever risk, high risk environment they're in. And you sit there and go, actually, there's a limit to what we can control. We can control a lot, but there's a limit to what we can, especially the social, commercial, reputational factors that are trying to be dealt with. And that sort of brings me on to, you know, the second story piece, because, you know, I've heard you talk and we've talked in person. There's a big backstory to this, and hearing you sort of describe those tensions and the piece you shared recently about adventure sporting, I think is applicable in many areas. So can you sort of rewind and tell us the sort of the second story and how it really ended up in the situation you're in, as opposed to that simple first linear judgmental story that often people tell?
Yeah. How far do you want to go back?
Well, we've got about 25 minutes. So, and that's including the sort of discussion piece. So, make it fit that time.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things, and I may be wrong in my interpretation of Diane Bond's work, you know, or normalization of deviance, you know, mm-hmm. use of that ideal. And I think that goes back a long way, like a really long way. Like, you know, my reading takes me back to, you know, the pre-Socratics. Mm-hmm. And Socrates kind of made this decision to kind of latch on to logos or logic. Mm-hmm. And leaving behind eros, kind of. And so, and that's logos is left brain and mm-hmm. and eros is right brain, right? And so for me, those two were battling mm-hmm. right from the get-go, right? Like the logos was saying, okay, you need to take this job. And Eros was saying, no, this is a bad fit. This is not a good thing for you to do. And our, you know, this normalization of deviance, I actually think that it goes deeper than kind of, you know, organizations. It's kind of like Western culture, right? Like we like to have a logical process for things. But if we take that too far, mm-hmm. if we take logical processes too far, we can actually, we kind of tip into what in the psychology is intellectualization. And that's kind of when we want to avoid the pain of a, you know, kind of the acute pain of a situation, we end up in chronic pain where we end up doing something that perhaps we, you know, didn't intend. And so we can, you know, we go through this kind of intellectual process and you're right. It's like, how did it make sense? Yeah. Right? And it does make sense. Like everything about my choice to go work at that operation made sense. I was going to be pushed. I was going to be challenged. I was going to learn a whole bunch of things.
You had some bills to pay.
I had bills to pay. You know, we just finished building a new post and beam straw bale house in Revelstoke. And it was all, you know, pretty exciting. And all of those things are still true.
Yeah.
Like, I was pushed. I learned a lot.
Yeah. They didn't actively cause the accident or the event.
No.
But it's all of these bits that are stacking up that card that, you know, we talk about the Jenga tower, that these things occur and it's really easy to spot them after the event. You go, dit, 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 dit. But in real time, actually, they lead to success too. And I think that's the other bit that people forget is that those same conditions are what gives us rewards. I interrupted you. Yeah, go for it.
No. You know, our conversation started with, well, what do we do with uncertainty?
Mm.
And Eros, the right brain, is all about uncertainty. It's all about kind of, you know, well, I'm not sure how I know this, but, right?
Like, feels about right.
You know, and that was the uncertainty. Like, if I had said no to going to work up there, I would have entered into uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right, like I don't know what I'm going to do, and I'm sure something, you know, will happen, right? And so sometimes we get into trouble because we try to solve a problem too quickly,
mm-hmm.
because we don't want to be in uncertainty.
And that's an interesting paradox, because if you stay in that situation, you have got a level of certainty, because you know the status quo. So there's an interesting piece there, and reading Annie Duke's Quit was actually the bit about when we quit something, it's got a level of uncertainty associated with it. But once we quit and commit, then there is a level of certainty. So our whole life is a really interesting piece here.
Yes. Yeah. And so, and I had many opportunities, lots of opportunity to exercise stepping into uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and here's the other thing, Gareth, is that I actually perceived I didn't have a choice. Mm. Right? Like, oh, I've got to take this job. Oh, I need to kind of stay here. It's just like, well, wait a second. The other part of our earlier conversation was kind of this idea of kind of being the observer of what's happening.
Mm.
We didn't actually use those words, but that's consciousness.
Yeah.
Right? Like our thoughts are not consciousness, but our observing of our thoughts is
the actual...
Yeah,
that's the metacognition piece, the thinking about thinking. Yeah.
Yes, the thinking about thinking and observing our thoughts and then observing. And when we kind of assume the observer role, then we actually realize, oh, we've got more choice.
Mm.
Right? And when we have more choice, then we realize, well, I can make a higher level choice here. What's the highest level choice I can make?
Interesting.
And so in the courses that I teach, that's fundamentally what it's about. Mm-hmm. Is, and it's connected to values, right? And so the observer of how am I showing up in this situation? And well, I'm showing up as being kind of scared. And fear is good because it's like,
it's sharpening.
It sharpens the saw, if you will. But we can then choose, well, actually, I should probably behave a little bit more courageously. And that might mean saying something that I'm afraid to say, or it might mean doing something that I'm afraid to do. It might mean like even our conversation about what to do when somebody's missing at the end of a dive with, you were 50 and now you're 49. It's a courageous thing to actually say, well, there's nothing we can do. We've got to call the police.
Yeah.
Like profoundly courageous. And,
absolutely.
You know, to dive back down is actually probably motivated in fear. Fear of the reality of what is actually happening.
Yeah.
The way that
sort of courage displays itself in the decisions we've got. Last weekend, I gave a presentation about heroes and villains, and somebody asked me, you know, what's a hero? And I said, it's somebody who's challenging an adverse situation. And that could be a physical thing. It could be a social thing. It could be a cultural thing. I talked about Ignaz Semmelweis in the healthcare space. Hugely courageous to challenge the status quo of how infections happened, and ended up getting kicked out, put into a mental home, and then unfortunately dying through sepsis, having been beaten up in the prison. And so that's a hero. But you sit there and go, you know, but all he did was he spoke up. The whistleblowers in Boeing, hugely courageous. You know, you're going against the whole sort of flow. So I think courage is a really interesting piece, and it frustrates me where leaders, those who aren't that great at leading, more probably management, is people should be courageous to speak up and challenge us. It's like, that's not easy to do. You know, they should be aware of, you know, if they believe in it, speak up. How much are you willing to sacrifice? That's the courageous, the other side of the courageous coin is, what's the potential for loss here? What could I lose?
Yeah, and really the only thing we truly have is our integrity.
Mm.
Right? Like, that's the only thing we truly have. And when we look at ourselves in the mirror, if we live our lives in a courageous fashion, we like who we see.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so we're managing a risk there too. Right? Like, if we don't like ourselves, we put ourselves in all kinds of situations that are really dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So the sort of how did you navigate that in reality?
How did I navigate?
Yeah. So how did you navigate those tensions? And then what have you learned as a consequence of the event?
Cowardice, faint-heartedness, isolation. Okay. I didn't navigate those tensions in a way that managed the situation.
Yeah. Interesting. So is that informed by hindsight? Because at that time, you must have thought that you were managing them effectively.
No, I knew I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I knew that I was afraid to do what needed to be done. And okay. I'm not sure exactly what I was afraid of. And, here's the hindsight piece, is I think I was afraid of being yelled at, but the being yelled at is like minuscule. And it's the other person's stuff too. So compared to what happened.
Well, so
that's the hindsight stuff.
So it's an interesting piece that, and I think it's Timothy Clark in his 4 Stages of Psychological Safety. He talks about psychological harm and hurt can be more tragic and more painful than physical harm. Because we know that we get hurt. You break your leg or you have something serious happen, that passes. But psychological harm can go on much longer and be much more hurtful than that. Notwithstanding the loss of life that's there, but from a personal point of view. So I think the psychological piece is more harmful or more hurtful.
Potentially, like it depends on... It depends on what work we've done as a person, right? So, when I map my kind of experience post-incident, I was really sensitive to what people might have said about the tragedy. Mm-hmm. And actually, somebody asked me the question, well, why'd you go there? Like, it seems pretty obvious that, it was a bad place to go and why'd you go there? And that felt really, at the time, it was like devastating. But what I've written about that since then is it was the most important question to ask. Mm-hmm. Because it actually led me down this path of, okay, so why did I go there? And unpacking that was really like an incredible experience.
So I'm just thinking there of, often, that is a first story question. Why did you go there?
Yes.
And you're right, people can get really defensive about those things. But ultimately, that's a backhanded way of reflect on this. But people don't.
Yes. Well, yeah. And it is a backhanded way. And I still perceive today that the intention was to point a finger.
Yeah.
I still really believe that. But at the same time, the only thing I have is how I respond to it. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I actually now see it as a gift, because it really kind of drove me to learn not only about myself, but how I was responding to the situation at the time. And I guess probably the most important thing was for me was that I was ignoring the arrow side of, or my right brain side of it. Mm-hmm. Because it's interesting, that your podcast name is How Did It Make Sense? It didn't make sense to me at the time. It did not make sense to me. Mm-hmm. I was terrified of being there, and I abandoned my own kind of better judgment and my own better. And that's not a judgment, it's an observation, which has been really powerful, because I realized that there was this whole other side to risk management. And which we don't attend to very much in Western society, because it doesn't make sense. And mm-hmm. that's just like, okay. This doesn't just, there's everything about this is wrong. but I don't know exactly why. And I did have a lot of reasons why I knew it was wrong. But if somebody asked me, well, why wouldn't you go? It's just like, well, there's this and this and this. And it's like, well, we're managing it. And it's like, well, still, that's not going to be enough.
So the reward. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of rewards associated. We talk about risk as invariably a negative piece. But risk is loss and reward.
Yes.
And one of the things that sort of picking up more recently about, you know, readings and understanding this bit is the reward aspect is nearly always ignored when we look at these adverse events and we just look at the why didn't they spot the bad things, and nobody asks the question, what's the positive, what's the bit that's driving people, the emotional piece, the social piece. And yeah, that I think is a really powerful piece that we need to look at.
Yeah. And in the backcountry skiing paradigm, the thing that's driving the reward piece is so much kind of media reinforcement of the reward.
The GoPro culture, right? That goes with it of, look at this. Awesome. First tracks, fresh place. Nobody's been there before. Scenery's awesome.
And this is really interesting because, not to pick on GoPro here, but their marketing campaign is Be a Hero.
Yeah.
And it's really important that your definition of hero was actually a good one. Skiing a slope is not heroic. If we do something that's, you know, if you will, going against the status quo for the benefit of others, then that's heroic. That's heroic. Whereas the, you know, diving down to the wreck 30 meters.
Yeah.
You know,
so there's an interesting, yeah, I mean, I agree. And actually, this one of the bits that you'd mentioned in the previous section that I want to pick up now is the ability to overcome those stressors that you've had. So when somebody says to you, why did you do that in an accusatory tone, you then reflect on it and go, here's an opportunity. Yeah. How did you and how can others learn from that, digging deep to reflect and say, instead of getting massively internalized, hurt, you've turned it around. So that, I would say, is a heroic approach because you're able to share that.
Yeah, and that's why my company is named Archetypal, because it comes down to archetypes. And so how did I? It's like recognizing that, okay, I could respond to this in the victim archetype.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could respond to this in a heroic archetype where I learn from this and actually then pass on lessons to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, and if some one person benefits, then it's worth it. Right. Like, and so this whole idea of, you know, how we show up to situations, I think is really powerful in kind of the, you know, managing hazard space or safety space, in that when we use kind of our observer to kind of observe how we're showing up, oh my God, I'm actually showing up in the addict archetype.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really powerful, right? I'm addicted to this thing that I call diving or backcountry skiing. It's like, holy shit, like I'm not listening to, and I'm behaving exactly like an addict. I'm not listening to my friends. I'm not listening to, you know, my spouse. I'm not listening. And they're trying to call me out and I just think they're nuts. Right.
No, that's really powerful.
And okay, so how do I elevate myself out of this addict archetype and maybe into the, I don't know, alchemist, you know, where I use this adventure experience to change me instead of being addicted to the turns or addicted to the dive. I use it to change me, you know, and I'm using the alchemist to, it's not anything woo. It's just kind of like,
Yeah.
Oh, it's using it as a metaphor for transformation. How do I use my adventure to transform me?
Yeah.
And I hear that so much in your work, Garrett. Like you're all about, you know, okay, how do we use this to learn and transform?
That's really interesting. It's one. So I recently, probably 2 months ago, rebranded for Human in the System, and I went through an archetypal study piece, and the Alchemist was one of them that came out, and the two that I sort of settled on as the strongest ones were Provocateur and Mentor, and it's about that challenging thought process. You sit there and go, here, look at this. Oh, I don't want to look in the mirror. No, look. You're the ones that have got the answers. I can sort of point you in that sort of direction, but ultimately you find the solutions to your problems that we've sort of co-identified and then co-created the journey. So the archetypes are really interesting. It's the first time I've come across this, and a shout out to Mickey and Chris for that, because you sit there going, that sort of hits the buttons.
Yes.
So
and it's the archetypical journey to go from kind of a, if you will, low vibration archetype to kind of a higher vibration archetype, right? Like we're operating at a higher level because it's never ending, right? Like there's no arrival. It's a practice.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, for the millionth time, I'm showing up as the addict archetype. Okay, here we go. I'm going to elevate.
Yeah, and how do I spot them? I'm in it, because like a lot of these things, when you're in the tunnel, you don't know you're in the tunnel. So, because it's just you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
This is really, really cool stuff. And I love hearing the different perspectives that you give to what could be quite a simple thing about just taking more care, being more careful, you know, just paying more attention to the threats that are around you. But actually, if we don't understand those pressures, the social, cultural, technical pressures that are around us, the judgment is easy. And I think the bit that I loved about this piece is your ability to turn what could become quite a negative thing. And I know when I first started doing the work that I was doing in the diving space, people just turned around to me and said, you know what, you're just doing this for the money. And that was like a stab in the heart to me. That was a real sort of, you've hit my values, my integrity, and it's absolutely not that at all. And that's what's carried me through these difficult pieces. So I think, you know, your ability to say, somebody's accused me in a judgmental way, but actually you've used that as a mirror to look back and say, who am I? And how did I get to where I am?
And that's the true adventure.
Mm.
Right? Like, and you know, you asked for a book recommendation, and the greatest teaching for me was Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces. And everybody knows it because, and they know it by vicariously, mm-hmm. because, that was the basis for the Star Wars trilogy, right? Like George Lucas was struggling with the screenplay for Star Wars. And then he read Hero with a Thousand Faces. And Joe Campbell had studied mythologies from around the world. And mythology, like we have this kind of funny relationship with mythology right now because we think myths are untrue, but really, they're kind of universal truths about the human condition. And so Joe Campbell was realizing that all of these different cultures, all of these different societies were all telling the same story about the human journey.
Mm.
And so he created this algorithm about the human journey, which he called the hero's journey.
Ah, yes. Go on. And, so it all comes. So tell people who've not heard about the hero story.
Well, the hero. Okay. Journey. Well, I'll use the algorithm, but I'll use Luke Skywalker. The algorithm. Yep. The hero has a there's a call to adventure, and the hero denies the call. So Luke Skywalker was asked for help, and he said, well, I can't do this. But then he goes back to his family and realizes his home had been burned, and he had no choice. So then there's a refusal of a call, then there's an enter into the call. And then there's, you know, finding a teacher and getting special tools from the mm-hmm. teacher. And then meeting, and then coming up, you know, against all these challenges. And then meeting the father figure, which is Darth Vader.
Yeah.
And, you know, the person that's trying to tell us what to do with our life, but we and if we let... If we listen to them, then we're in trouble because yeah. we're not on our own journey. And then eventually, you know, and then there's the trash compactor scene where it's the belly of the whale, where we're in the adventure and we're swallowed by it and we just have to figure it out. There's a ton of uncertainty. We're like in there. And eventually we go through all these trials and come back and we have something to teach.
Awesome.
And so Joseph Campbell's work is, you know, I think in some ways fundamental to, you know, risk management or hazard management from the perspective of, in the process of developing ourselves, we make better choices. And in the process, and we gain better awareness of how we're showing up to the adventure. And so we can go through the process of elevating how we show up, and we make different choices, and we potentially have better outcomes.
Cool. Thank you for that. It's somebody else recommended The Hero's Journey just recently. So but I think he called it something else. So I'll go and there must be a number of stories on there, but I'm pretty sure it's Joseph Campbell.
Sorry. Hero with a Thousand Faces is the title of the book, but the algorithm is called The Hero's Journey. And, you know, I don't think that it's, you know, kind of male-female specific. I think that, it's the human journey, you know, and really is what that's about. And I think I've got this interesting card deck that I use with my courses, and it's called the Human Journey Card Deck. And so I guess what it does, what I've noticed, Gareth, is that when we look at technology, we have a lot of resolution, right? Like we can parcel things out really kind of, you know, there's a lot of understanding of the technology. But then when we start to look at ourselves, we have these grand generalizations like, well, if you will, normalization of deviance. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
Like, if I want to lose weight, it's like, okay, I want to lose weight. Okay, like, what's the higher resolution of that? The higher resolution is, okay, I've got to exercise 4 times a week. I've got to, you know, have less carbohydrate intake. I've got to get a better sleep. I've got to drink more water. You know, there's a deeper resolution. And the same is true of the human side of the journey, is that we need tools, and that's what I now see is like the deeper resolution. You know, so for example, courage has, you know, the idea of courage, there's social, there's intellectual courage is, do I speak up? But it's also being able to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's moral courage, there's spiritual courage, there's all these kind of deeper levels of courage. Yeah. And then you can take each one, like, okay, so how do we unpack social courage, right? Okay, well, there's a whole bunch of resolution to that too. So
so where can people find you to find more of this stuff that's there? So a quick plug for you and where you're based physically and get people online.
I'm based physically on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada, in Mill Bay. But they can find me online at archetypal, archetypal.ca. Archetypal.ca.
Excellent. I love the fact that you had to read that off the box cover as you were looking at it.
I'm dyslexic.
So there we go. This is the context as to what that the case. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Ken, thank you for your time. No, go on. You were going to say something then. Go on.
Thank you so much. Like, yeah, it's, you know, it's fun to have a conversation and riff off each other. And yeah, I think that the work you're doing is really important. So you're not doing it for the money. Keep going, keep doing it. And there's also kind of an energy to how you do your work, which is really positive. So thank you.
Thank you. And I hope to meet you again sometime. I'm probably going to be coming back out to the island in March for another one of Guy Shockey's Edge sessions. So if that happens, I'll certainly look you up. But thank you very much. Right. In fact, I'm probably going to be out for the Canadian Underwater Conference, which is happening, I think, in February time. So either way, when I'm across that side, I'm going to go and look you up again.
Right, we'll have to have a dinner together. It might subject you to my cooking.
Awesome. Well, you've lived that far, so it can't be that bad. So,
all right.
Thank you very much, Ken.
See you.